To order, might as well. Then we can just talk with the meeting called to order. Okay, with the special joint meeting with taxes is because there are a whole bunch of bills on tax compliance, which kind of works through both committees, although they end up, whatever we do on tax compliance, which is adding people to the budget, they have to know about it, but the bills go through our committee. So we thought that the best way to handle that would be a joint committee. And since they have more members than we do, I think we did it at their time in their room, because they have almost twice as many members as we do. And so I then added, it turned out that the tax committee had already heard the full legislative auditor's report on the issue of tax compliance. And so we were trying to get that meeting finished in the allotted time, so we thought to save time on Monday, we'll do at least the executive summary of the legislative auditor's tax compliance report. And we may go back, before we put our bill together, we may go back to a more thorough one. But this is just to bring us slightly up to speed with the tax committee on Monday. And so I apologize to Commissioner Salamone that we may not, because we added something to the agenda, we may not finish today, so we'll have to bring them back at some point. Okay, ready to begin? Thank you so much for being able to do this on such short notice, too.
Madam Chair, I'm here because the great Plowers of MnDOT are here as I flew up from the south end of Eagan about 35 minutes ago.
Oh, my gosh. If I had known that was being required, I might have been more hesitant to call this. So I'm sorry I didn't know that.
Problem, something for MnDOT, and, you know, the next time that OLA releases a report that doesn't agree with your policy positions, put another plus in our column for making it here from the south end of Eagan.
Okay.
I'm going to give you the quick version, I hope, of the tax compliance report results. And excuse me, I'm using an older presentation, and I know your time constraints today, so I'm going to try to zoom through certain slides. And of course, if you have any questions after this, please get in touch with me. And, you know,
okay. Well, you need to say your name for the
I'm sorry. I'm Deborah Parker-Janot, and I am with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and I was the project manager for tax compliance, a report that we issued last year.
Okay, thank you.
So let me just jump right in, and I hope you'll kind of go with me on this groove of quick presentation today. First, we can state categorically, and the Department of Revenue has shown, that Minnesota has a tax compliance problem. First, the Department of Revenue has done a couple of studies to show what taxpayers ought to be paying in terms of Minnesota tax revenue, and that's what you see here on the screen. But these studies also establish that not every taxpayer pays what they owe. And for the income tax, the tax gap is about $600 million. And for the sales and use tax, it's about $451 million. Again, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, this is kind of an ideal estimate of what taxpayers should be paying in their tax due. Not all of this is collectible, but it does show what the tax compliance problem in Minnesota is. Let me talk a little bit more about the components of these tax gaps, and these are the areas that I think this committee should be interested in terms of evaluating the Department of Revenue's tax compliance efforts. First, for the income tax, most of the tax gap comes from underreported income, particularly underreported income by the self-employed. Non-filers count for about another $124 million. Making that $604 million income tax gap estimate. On the sales and use tax side, about $272 million comes from unpaid use tax, and another $180 million comes from unpaid sales tax. What does the Department Department of Revenue do? And these are the budget issues, I think, for this committee. Is what do they do to try to address tax compliance problems? First, they try to educate and assist taxpayers. They try to identify those taxpayers who may be non-compliant. They audit returns. They collect payments that are due. And also try to simplify the tax system itself. So it's important for the committee to remember that this compliance cycle is important. All elements of it are important in addressing the tax gap. Overall, we found that the revenues, Department of Revenue's tax compliance efforts can be improved. Overall, the strategies that they're using, as I just described, they're sound. You know, the department has the right approach. But we think they need to improve access to telephone assistance. They need to improve audit productivity, data for finding noncompliance, and collection of delinquent payments. Let me start first with tax audits. We have quite a few findings in the full report related to tax assistance, particularly in terms of access to timely responses when people call with telephone on the telephone with questions. And we think there are some taxpayer assistance issues for those who don't speak English as their first language. I'm not going to talk about those today, but I would urge you to look at the report and call me if you have any questions on those issues, because they are important. But today I'm going to talk about audit and collection. So, tax audits, what should they do? First, they should target those returns that are actually going to result in additional revenue to the state. They should target those areas of the tax gap that are responsible for most of the taxes not paid, and also they should encourage long-term voluntary compliance by having a sufficient audit presence and essentially, you know, a threat of audit that encourages people to comply with the law voluntarily. On average, we found that income tax audits were indeed productive, returning about $6.70 per dollar spent. And on the sales and use tax side, the audits raised over $5.40 per dollar spent. These estimates, though, do not include added revenue that may come from improved voluntary compliance. And again, voluntary compliance is like the holy grail of tax compliance issues, because what you really want are people to know what their obligations are and to pay those. There's a lot of burden on both the revenue side and the taxpayer side through active taxpayer compliance interactions. And so, again, you know, the focus is on improving voluntary compliance. We do think that some of the Department of Revenue's compliance resources should be redirected. For example, we found too many income tax returns, face-to-face income tax audits, that resulted in no change to tax due. And the rate for no change for the Department of Revenue was quite a bit higher than it was, for example, for similar IRS audits. And that's one area where we think they could improve. There were some audit projects that were repeated year after year in spite of the fact that they had below average results. We also think, you know, just overall, there was mixed success targeting the tax gap. There, for the non-filers, those are people who owe taxes but don't file a return at all. The Department of Revenue has actually ratcheted up its efforts in this area from about 4,000 audits per year to 10,000 in fiscal years 2002 to 2005. So this effort has really ratcheted up. The additional tax due that they identified was about $28 million a year, but I need to caution that it's hard to get those dollars in the door. Those non-filer assessments have been hard to collect. The department has also made limited progress in targeting underreported income. And again, this is a major chunk of income tax gap. These audits require very complex skills. They require highly skilled auditors. But because of some turnover issues and recruiting issues, the department hasn't been able to build the core staff that they need to address these kinds of audits. And I know that the commissioner or assistant commissioner will be talking about these this issue in more detail, but it's really been something that they've struggled with over the last couple of years. In addition, there's been a drop in the federal audit presence, because remember, the Minnesota income tax return is tightly linked to the federal income tax return. So in essence, a Minnesota audit comes to the same outcome as a federal audit. And so because the federal audit presence nationwide has dropped precipitously, Minnesota has suffered from that. The sales and use tax gap, again, $451 million. We found that the department audits a fairly small percentage of businesses in this area. There's little enforcement of the use tax for households. And again, you know, in the department's defense on this issue, the cost benefit here needs to be taken into account. In the department's view, it's not cost effective to pursue households when it comes to the use tax. And the use tax problem grows as e-commerce does. For those of you, let me just back up a little bit. Aren't sure what the use tax is? It's just like a sales tax. It's a tax that's owed at the same rates and on the same items for things that are purchased out of state, from out-of-state vendors. So it would include things like internet sales, catalog sales, and businesses that may buy things from out-of-state vendors. But the rate and the items taxed are still the same. So as e-commerce grows, Minnesota's tax compliance problem grows. We do think the department can make better use of data to find non-compliance. For example, there is a Fed-State program in which the IRS could, the Minnesota Department of Revenue could partner with the IRS so that our individual income tax returns, in essence, get processed through the IRS filters and edit checks so that we would benefit from the compliance checks that the IRS does. And of the states that have an income tax, Minnesota is one of only four that don't participate in that program. We also don't think that Minnesota makes effective use of W-2 wage tax statements. And these are the statements that employers file with the IRS and with the Department of Revenue that show how much wages are earned in a given year. And Minnesota still gets over a million of these on paper. And we think, in fact, that Minnesota employers should be required to file this information electronically so that Minnesota can make use of effective electronic data matching to make sure that both employers and employees are reporting the right information to the state. Let me shift gears a little bit. I've been talking about tax auditing, and that's finding out, are people reporting what they owe? There's another issue that we looked at the Department of Revenue, and that is for those people who know what they're supposed to pay, either through audit or they reported on their return, are they actually attaching the check and sending the money to the Department of Revenue? And these delinquent payments, as shown on the screen, can include the balance due reported on a return and audit assessments not paid within 60 days. And at the end of fiscal year 2005, remember this work that we did is a year old, that amount was $459 million of taxes due to the state that the taxpayers knew that they owed. 63% of those debts were late income tax payment debts. That amount has been growing by roughly 8% per year since fiscal year 2000, in part, as I said, because the Department of Revenue has really ramped up its individual audit income tax program, and that naturally has been increasing the collection of, you know, past due payments that are owed to the state. the department has done, you know, a good job increasing its collection activity, and collections have increased by 5% per year, but as I said, the amount flowing in has been increasing by 8%, so the Department of Revenue is not keeping pace with incoming delinquencies, so this tax debt or accounts receivable is growing every year. Part of the reason for that are some inefficiencies in the collection process. There are too many steps in case handoffs. The collection techniques are not tailored to the type of debt or debtor characteristics. So it's essentially a one-size-fits-all collection process. And part of that is resulting in very slow collection of debts, too, that 60% of their debts are more than a year old. And the older a debt gets, the harder it is to collect. And so that's part of why we're concerned. There are a very small percentage, less than 10% of the debts, account for over 70% of the accounts receivable. So there's a small proportion of debtors that account for a lot of the debt. And we think that the department could do more to focus in on those high dollar debtors to try to bring in some of this revenue. Not all of it is collectible. You know, if a debtor is in bankruptcy, for example, the department by federal law is precluded from pursuing that debt. So of the $460 million that I talked about, not all of that is actively collectible at one time, but we do think that they can do a better job of tailoring and targeting their collection activities. Part of what they need to do that is better data. The Department of Revenue does not have an integrated tax system that follows the taxpayer from the return they file to any audit activity to then any collection activity. And so we, you know, as researchers, had a terrible time trying to follow that trail and understand what kinds of debts were collectible, what kinds of audits resulted in collectible revenue. And just from a management perspective, we do think that an investment in an integrated tax revenue system at the department would be worthwhile. From a strictly practical perspective in doing the work that they do. So let me close with just one big point.
Fabulous.
It's not easy revenue, okay? We talked about it earlier. I said that there's almost $1 billion of a tax gap, but that is a theoretical tax gap, all right? This is not easy revenue. You will not be able to collect it all. It's not feasible from a practical perspective, and I think from the taxpayer's perspective, the level of intrusiveness and reporting that would be required to collect all that money, I think, would exceed our capacity to handle government intrusion. So if anything that you walk away from today, number one, yes, there is a tax compliance problem in Minnesota that deserves attention, but of the tax gap that's been reported, you're not going to get it all. Don't even think you will. I'm sure the department will reiterate that point. Reducing the tax gap depends on legislative actions, tax simplification, investments in computer systems, and data reporting issues. It will depend on the success of the department's strategies with tax compliance, and we made quite a few recommendations about better targeting their compliance activities, trying to improve their audit selection so they're not using resources on no-change tax audits, giving up on tax audit projects that, you know, have shown that they're not yielding additional revenue. And it also depends on federal action, and this is particularly important with the sales and use tax. There is a federal effort that Minnesota has been actively involved with to streamline, it's called the Streamline Sales Tax Project, and it's a way through federal action that would allow out-of-state vendors to collect sales tax on Minnesota's behalf. So that if I buy a product from a Massachusetts vendor, that vendor will actually collect Minnesota sales tax on that purchase and then remit it to Minnesota. That's probably the best solution to the sales use tax problem, but it will require federal action to make that reality. So Minnesota's been pursuing that. Department of Revenue's been very active in that. But it's probably going to take some federal action. And again, tax compliance is a long-term strategic effort. And let me go back to the point I made a little earlier that the Holy Grail is voluntary compliance. And improving voluntary compliance will take time. Last, you know, I've said this before, Minnesota won't collect all the tax gap, but we think improved collections are possible. The Department of Revenue has not had any trouble putting compliance initiative funding to good use. They have been able to increase their staffing in audit and collection, and that has produced revenue gains. They have sound strategies, but we think there, again, there's room to improve the execution of those compliance strategies. But kind of slow and steady is the name of the game here. At the time that we did our work, the department was really suffering from high turnover problems among its auditors. And it takes a long time to get a field auditor up and running to be able to produce, you know, good revenue and to be able to do the complex auditing, for example, that's required to go after the self-employed. And because the department's been churning a lot of staff, when we issued this report last year, and I think this message is still true now, it's important for them not to be jumping too fast into additional compliance initiatives. They really need to be able to get these staff on board, and they need to be able to keep them and build this capacity over time. So with that, the speed version, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer those.
Okay. I actually do have one, because it's something that I the last time that we looked at this a lot of years ago, I remembered the going back to your slide, which says on average audits are productive. Income tax audits raise $6.70 per dollar spent, and sales and use it was $5.40 per dollar spent. There's got to be some obvious limit on that.
Pardon?
There's got to be some obvious limit on that, you know, that per dollar spent.
Madam Chair, we did some analysis as to whether they had kind of hit the end of that, and we did not find that they'd hit the limits of their investment. The additional dollars that have been invested in compliance are still yielding additional revenue, and we don't think that cost benefit has zeroed out yet.
Okay. But that's still a straight line graph? At some point, it's got to.
At some point, it is, but we don't think they've hit diminishing returns yet.
Oh, okay.
At some point, of course, they will, but our analysis showed that they're not there yet.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for getting here. Questions?
Madam Chair, thank you. A question for our enthusiastic witness. I apologize to my colleagues at the outset if this has been asked. When I look at the documentation, there's a lot of good information in here about the tax gap. Mm-hmm. But I have a specific question about tax compliance. I know we've had a number of tax compliance initiatives in the very recent past.
You know, we're having a whole meeting on it with the tax committee on Monday.
So I can't put the witness on the hot seat about that. But Madam Chair, maybe what I'll do is then just withhold my question. But it's something I certainly hope we explore at that meeting about how successful we were when we were shaking the couch cushions there, so to speak, in tax compliance. Because my recollection is that we weren't nearly as successful as we thought we were going to be regarding tax compliance. And I'd certainly be interested in exploring the reasons why the Department of Revenue thinks we were unsuccessful and we didn't meet our goals. Were we too enthusiastic? Were we unrealistic?
I think we're going to hear that from. And again, this was the short version, the shortest version of this report. The tax committee gave them a whole meeting, and we may bring them back again. But the reason was to fit in with the meeting we had scheduled on Monday. I thought it was important for us to at least get this part of this.
Madam Chair, if I may. and Representative De La Forest, what we did was we didn't look at the initiative funding itself. Because you know what? The department doesn't pigeonhole that money for, you know, a single stream of effort. We thought it was more important to look at the Department of Revenue's compliance activities overall with the initiative funding and their base, essentially. So we merged that together in our analysis. And we looked at cost investments in the audit function and the collection function as well, because audit recommendations don't mean dollars in the door. So we tried to do a more comprehensive analysis, and the dollars that you see from us represent the investment in the audit activity and the collection activity to bring dollars that actually went into the general fund, not audit recommendations that were never collected. So we think that we've given you a fairly realistic picture of the department's overall compliance activities that include those initiatives, but kind of merge the whole thing together. And so we think it's a realistic picture. We think it's a better picture than looking only at something that tries to track that compliance initiative money narrowly. We think this is a better estimate of what the overall effort is.
Well, Madam Chair, I had one other question, but I'll make the observation. It is my suspicion that I think we were a bit too optimistic about our tax compliance goals as a legislature, and we gave you perhaps an unrealistic task. But my other question is, for the witness, I noticed you called voluntary compliance the holy grail, and so I'm going to ask Mr. Salamone to plug his ears because I know he disagrees with me at the outset on this, but I asked this in tax committee, and I don't think there are many others, perhaps no one who's on the tax committee in this committee.
That's right. So it's the second time you've heard this.
Well, but it's interesting, Madam Chair, because I want to know why the resistance to perhaps a very limited or defined tax amnesty. I mean, it's a form of voluntary compliance. It might be belated, but it is a form of voluntary compliance. And it's where, you know, why the resistance to at least exploring that possibility? You can unplug your ears, Mr. Salamone.
You might want to plug your ears, Madam Chair and Representative De La Forest. I think I agree. Based in part, I spent the first 13 years of my career at the Government Accountability Office auditing the IRS. I worked for GAO in Washington, D.C. in tax administration issues. And I think that tax amnesty works when you have a low baseline of compliance. And Minnesota, actually, relatively speaking, has a fairly high level of compliance, voluntary compliance, relative to a lot of other areas. And so with that context, you need to think about tax amnesty. You know, is it really worth it from a compliance perspective when we already have a relatively high level of voluntary compliance? Is tax amnesty the message that we want to send? And I'm not coming down, you know, with an official OLA opinion one way or the other, but I think that is an important issue to consider in terms of the message we want to send to Minnesota taxpayers.
She gave a far better answer than Mr. Salamone did in tax. Far more persuasive. Send her next time.
Thank you. Works better for library books, I think. Anyone else? Representative Ringo.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for background information. When I was on the campaign this summer and fall, I heard from a business owner who was audited, she said, I think 2 years in a row, for the sales tax as a small plumbing business. And the information that she had was that it was that these audits were picked at random for this particular process. And I guess what I'm wondering, just give me some basic background on how audits are done, both in the sales tax, because you said there are a few of them, and sort of how they're selected for who is selected for audits, whether it's random or if there's data that you use to look for profiles, et cetera.
Is that a question for OLA or a question for the department?
I think it's a brief answer.
Okay.
Yeah. Most of the audits that the department undertakes are for segments of the population because there is some indicator of a possible compliance issue. And they use a variety of audit selection techniques, most of which I can't discuss because they're not public. But they're very few are random. Occasionally, and this is really actually a very important function at the department, they may do a random audit within a sector to find out what is the relative level of noncompliance in the sector. Is this an area that we should have a more targeted audit program? So there's a very important function of random auditing, but that's actually not, I think, the focus of the most of the auditing that the department does. And the deputy commissioner, I'm sure, can speak more to that. But it's possible to get hit, I guess, twice with random audits, but most of the auditing that they do is targeted, and it's in fact the selection techniques that they use for those audit projects that, you know, we think they need to continue to evaluate and reassess so that they're really going after those returns that are most likely to achieve a revenue yield or are most likely to achieve an audit presence again, which is an incentive for people to comply voluntarily.
Anyone else? Director Sure, just very quickly. If we don't pigeonhole those tax compliance monies that we appropriate for, we're told the numbers, if we appropriate $10 million, we'll get 40 back, or we'll get 35 back, or 51 back. And we've been doing this for how many years, I don't know. If we don't specifically identify those monies, how do we know? I'm not able to put together in my mind, how do we know what revenues we bring in out of compliance if we're not able to directly pigeonhole the dollars, the additional monies that we give to the Department of Revenue to collect those monies?
Madam Chair, Representative Swigum, I think it's probably important to do both. With the limited resources that we had on this evaluation, we thought it was more important to look at the Department of Revenue as a whole. I understand your perspective for tracking those individual dollars, and the department's able to do that in the sense that they know who they hire, and they can track those employees' productivity, I guess, through the chain. But there's also an opportunity cost associated with that, in that you have experienced auditors who are taking time away from their work to train the new auditors. And so we wanted to provide that entire picture, you know, that try to pull all of that together. So we're not saying it's wrong to track it separately, but I think looking only at those new hires from the compliance initiative perhaps isn't giving you the whole picture, and that it's important to look at that train of money, but also to ask the department, tell me how you're doing overall. And that's what we tried to do, because I think that part of the picture was missing, and we tried to fill in on that.
So, Madam Chair, should I look at it as the positive or the negative? Should I look at it as the positive that with these additional appropriations for tax compliance, we're able to bring in so much revenue, and that's a good thing, the department's doing its job? Or should I look at it from the other standpoint as saying we're not doing our job because we have so many delinquent, non-compliant taxes out there?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's positive. The numbers that we show are that for the income tax and the sales tax, that there is, you know, 5-to-1, 6-to-1 ratio of additional revenue to the dollar invested in those efforts.
But there is some law diminishing return, or we give them $100 million, you get $700 million,
right? Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's got to be slow and steady. I think at some point you may throw a lot more money at revenue, but they're not going to be able to bring on those people, train them, and have them do the job. So it needs to be, I think, an incremental increase in the compliance activity. Yes, we think there is, they've not hit the point of diminishing returns, but you can't push them too fast. Because again, with these turnover issues in our office, if I could make a little pitch, we've had some of the same issues with attracting and retaining auditors, CPAs, and the Department of Revenue has had the same issue. There are some public-private sector pay issues that have inhibited the department's ability to attract and retain the employees that they need. So, yes, we think there's additional revenue could be gained from investments in compliance, We think the department could do a better job using the investments that have already been made, and those are the recommendations that we made. But I would caution that throwing another, I don't know, $500 million won't yield what you expect because of the logistics of using those dollars. And I know the Department of Revenue can speak to you more about some of those issues, but I think the department and we are on the same page with that.
Okay. We did. Thank you again very much
okay.
for coming.
And we happy did to keep, be here. Thank you.
We did keep revenue beyond. Well, I'm sure they wanted to hear this. They wanted to hear us hear this anyway. So now go on to the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Salamone. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. We have a number of slides we want to use to give you an overview of the department and its budget, past and present, as well as the change items in the governor's budget. Before I do that, if you will indulge me, I would like to respond to some of the items that were just discussed while they're sort of on my mind. There was a question about the validity and success of past compliance initiatives. I will note that all of the past compliance initiatives have provided more than the amount that was promised when they were enacted. That's not to say we will not have diminishing returns. I'm a big believer in diminishing returns as an economist. I had a professor who once said if it were not for diminishing returns, we could grow the world's food supply in a flower pot. So we do have to be mindful that there are constraints when you're expanding operations, and if you can't scale up the entire operation, you run into diminishing returns. I will note that the legislative auditor did a compliance audit back in 2003 or 2004, or maybe a little later, but it was an audit of tax compliance initiatives through that time period, and they certified the rates of return on those compliance initiatives as being correct and that we were not double counting revenues and so on. So I think it's important to know that. I also would like to make a few comments about the tax gap. It's been given a lot of play up here. There have only been about three studies nationwide of tax gaps. Minnesota is one of the first to do a state study. We were followed up by New York, I believe, and the IRS recently did their own tax gap study. And I will note that our tax gap study is about 11% of our revenues. New York's about 14%. IRS is about 20%. So with three or four data points, we know at least that our tax gap is smaller than the others that are being reported. It's also very important for you to know that the tax gap, as Deb mentioned, is a theoretical number. It's not based on actual tax returns. We're looking instead at census data and other data about the Minnesota economy and inferring from the data what we might expect to collect in taxes if all taxpayers were 100% compliant. And that's, you know, just never going to happen. We're never going to get to 100% compliance. And again, we're not looking at actual tax assessments when we're talking about the roughly $1.1 billion between income and sales. So it's really important to be realistic about what can be done with the tax gap, what can be done with a compliance initiative. That said, I would like to walk you through the slides there. I believe everyone has a handout, and we'll try to be as brief as we can. I'll just keep rolling along unless I get interrupted with questions. Our mission, our department's mission, is very succinct. It says our mission is to make the revenue system work well for Minnesota. That is a result of hours and hours of debate among staff and leadership about what our central mission statement ought to read. This is very broad, but it's something that every one of our employees has memorized. And we can talk about what work well for Minnesota means. But it encompasses all of the functions that we provide, which are shown in this next slide, and Deb alluded to the compliance cycle. This is another version of it, which shows you the major functions we perform in order to get the revenues collected that are due to the state of Minnesota based on our tax law. So we inform the taxpayers of their responsibilities to file. We serve them with information and methods for filing their tax returns and making sure they have all the information they need to meet their obligations. When those returns come in, we expend considerable time and resources in processing those tax returns, accounting for all the information, identifying taxpayers, storing information. That is one of the bigger parts of our department, actually, in that process arrow there. Once the information is on our system, I should say systems plural, because we're going to talk later about the problem we're having with our fragmented computer systems. Deb mentioned the need for an integrated tax system. When we collect all this information, it is then available to our audit folks, who then can do what they do best, and that is to look for patterns of noncompliance and determine who needs to be audited. And so here we're slipping into now the non-voluntary compliance. And Deb is absolutely correct. Some very high percentage. Do you remember, Dennis, the number of our money that comes in voluntarily? It's about 75-80%, or even
no, 90.
Oh, it's 90%. 90% of the state's revenue comes in voluntarily, with no effort on the part of the department, other than the education and front end work that we do to make sure people understand what their obligations are. So we want to keep that number high, and we want to get it even higher if we can. When we determine that taxpayers need a little more encouragement to pay their taxes, we move into the enforcement mode, and we have lots of enforcement tools to help us get those taxes collected. In the whole process of working through the revenue cycle, we get quite knowledgeable about what kinds of law changes we think would help increase compliance. And it may be tax policy changes in terms of different structure for the tax system, or it may be tools that we feel we need to do a better job of collecting revenue. So it's really our circle of life, if you will, in the revenue department, this so-called compliance cycle. Some statistics, I won't read them all to you. We are a big department. We process $3.5 million in individual income tax for individual income tax payers. That's actually about $2.5 million in returns. 165,000 withholding taxpayers, 625,000 property tax refund claimants, and it goes on and on. I won't read all the numbers to you. You see the significant number of business tax returns that we're dealing with. So it's a very complex department. We administer about $16 billion worth of tax revenue every year, and it's through about 28 different tax types. So we have quite a large portfolio of taxes. Obviously, the major ones are the income tax and sales tax. We have a very big presence, though, also in administering the local property tax. It's a significant part of what we do. Annually, on the next slide, you'll see that we collect and account for nearly $17 billion in revenue. We provide forms and instructions for over 4 million taxpayers, 5 million filing and payment transactions coming through. One statistic we're very proud of is that we process and pay 96% of income tax returns in less than 5 days. And taxpayers are quite pleased with that. If they give us their accounting, their routing numbers for their checking account, we can do even better than that in the early days of the filing season. As we get into the later days of the filing season, that number creeps up a little bit, but lately it has not gotten very much greater than 10 days. So it's a tremendous improvement, in part because we are at about nearly 70% electronic file, one of the highest states in the country. In fact, we are, I think, among the top two in the country. So we're very happy and proud of that statistic. Answering telephone calls is a very important thing that we do, and we field about 500,000 calls a year. We do audits, 90,000 a year, assess over $300 million. We do collect about $200 million in delinquent taxes. Deb mentioned our end of fiscal 05 stock of debt, tax debt, was about $459 million. It's important to note also that we do collect non-tax debt, and it's a growing line of business for us as agencies come to us and want to take advantage of our expertise in processing tax transactions. There's about $309 million of non-tax debt on our system. Much of that is child support and a couple of other large categories that I can't recall at the moment. So we're very big into debt collection. We have a very well-developed operation in that regard. Our department, since the early, since about 2002, has gone through a transition. over the years, we've had several tax compliance initiatives. I think there have been about three, and we're working on our fourth one. The governor has proposed, I believe, a fifth one, if I'm counting right. And usually these initiatives come with strings attached, that the money, the dollars we're given are intended to be applied to our most direct compliance activities. That we sort of were required to not use that money for support functions, quote unquote. As a result of that, the department has had a shift internally in the share of our department that is support versus sort of close direct compliance. There are really four factors. One is the transformation from paper to electronic filing that has allowed us to divert more funds into the compliance end of the house. Secondly, the creation of web-based services that replace a higher cost mail and telephone-based services. So we, in effect, we've been gradually replacing lower valued activity in the department with higher value activity by rerouting people from these lower valued functions to the higher valued functions. There's been, as I mentioned, a stepped up tax compliance that has caused a shift in our resources. I'll have a chart in a minute. And finally, we've had budget cuts like other agencies. In 2003, when we got our allocation for our budget cut, we basically were told to protect the compliance end of the operation and have the cut be fully implemented on our support side. And so we did take about a 15% reduction in the support side of our budget in 2003. And by way of definition, on the next slide, when I talk about direct compliance versus compliance support, these are the divisions in the Department of Revenue that fit into those categories. Direct compliance are our main tax divisions: income, corporate, sales, property, petroleum, special, withholding. Our collections division and our criminal investigations, we'll put all of that, we consider that part of direct compliance. Compliance support are return and payment processing, and we can debate maybe that some of these are in the wrong column. Technology, tax forms and information services, financial reporting, tax research. We have a well-developed tax research function. When the tax committee gets a bill, they get an estimate from our tax research division, and it's high quality and nonpartisan. And I'm proud to say that I was involved in setting that up in 1977 when I first came to the Department of Revenue. We have a appeals and service, appeals and legal in that support area, our commissioner's office, and our HR. So with those definitions, you look at the next slide, it documents the shift that we've undergone over the last several biennia from 2000 to 2001, where we were 52% compliance support, 48% direct compliance, to 35% compliance support and 65% direct compliance. Now, that is an understandable and maybe a good trend, and I can't tell you what the correct or optimal split would be there on that, but that is a graphic depiction of the change we've undergone in the last several biennia. As far as our staffing, our full-time equivalent numbers are shown in the next graph here. If you'll look at the bar for 2006, you'll see our complement is 1,225 FTEs. That does not include the compliance initiative positions that the governor is currently proposing. And you'll also note that our complement has been dropping since 1996 through 2002, and then with the advent of the compliance initiative, we've been building that compliance, that FTE up in those latter years. But we face major challenges as a department, and some of these are unique. In fact, most of these are unique to the Department of Revenue. Other agencies might be facing similar challenges. The first is our, and probably one of the most important ones for us, is our aging and fragmented computer system. Deb mentioned the importance of having an integrated tax system. We have a very disintegrated tax system that has developed over the years, partly because of inadequate funding to put in a more holistic processing system. So we have many different small systems that are used to process our taxes. And I have a lot to say about that in this presentation. But we're suffering from the fact that because of these fragmented systems, when a taxpayer calls and has a question for us, we may have to go in and out of four or five different computer databases to get an answer. And sometimes the answers don't line up. That is, you may get different data from a different computer system. And so we want to move away from that to one that is more integrated and that will provide us quality service, quality data, and also allow us to answer any taxpayer's question with one telephone, one check of a computer system. A second priority, I'll have more on the computer issues. A second and very worrisome trend is the aging of the workforce. This is not just a revenue problem, it's a state problem. And I know the Department of Administration is and Department of Employee Relations is very concerned about this and are making plans. But we have some unique issues there I want to talk about. We over the next 3 or 4 years, we will lose about 20 to 25% of our leadership in the Department of Revenue. We are one of the older agencies of state government. But I know there are several other large agencies in the same shape that we're in. I heard this morning that by 2015, we will lose a significantly greater percentage, roughly 50% of our leadership. So that's a problem for us in terms of making sure that we have people coming up in the ranks who can take over these leadership jobs. I'll show you a chart in a little while, the age distribution of our employees, and it's a little frightening. Third, we have been experiencing steep competition for accountants. Deb made a reference to that in her presentation. Since the enactment of Sarbanes-Oxley in, I believe, 2002, there's been a tremendous increase in demand for accountants in the private sector as well as in the public sector, but particularly in the private sector. The salaries in the private sector for accountants have gone up dramatically. We don't have the flexibility, the state doesn't have the flexibility in its current personnel system to have the salaries of our accountants track with the market. And so we have been losing at a regular, at a predictable rate, we've been losing new accountants after, usually within a year or two after they're fully trained in. So about the time we get them to be productive as new accountants, an offer comes along from the private sector for sometimes $5,000 to $10,000 a year more. So it's a real difficulty for us. We did a study a while back that showed within the first couple of years, we lose about 33% of newly hired accounting positions. So, and these are the high productive auditors, for example. So we're very concerned about that. We have taken steps in the near term to try to ease the pressure a little bit by entering into a memo of understanding with the Department of Employee Relations and the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees that gives us a little more flexibility within the state system to provide more rapid increases in salary early on, and that's helped a little bit, but it's not solving the problem. A fourth challenge is a growing diversity of the population. We have, it used to be that we could be quite comfortable having our tax forms and instructions in English only. Now we have to be concerned about just a whole long list of other cultures, other languages that need special attention, special instructions. And so we're working as hard as we can to provide those instructions and forms in multiple languages. And that's a real challenge for us. There's also a telephone service aspect to that where it's very difficult to provide the kind of service over the phone that some of these folks need. We have to get a translator or pay for a service that is very costly to be able to give them service in the language that they're comfortable with. The last three on that slide are a little more longer term. Changes in the economy clearly are a growing challenge for us as a state, actually for every state. Revenue systems are constantly being challenged by changes in the economy, changes we could never have predicted earlier. Deb mentioned the electronic commerce, people buying goods and services over the internet. That's been a tremendous growth area. And we are prohibited by a U.S. Supreme Court decision called the Quill case. We are prohibited from enforcing our sales tax on vendors outside of Minnesota who have no physical presence here. And so that's been a real issue for us. Deb mentioned that the federal legislation is needed to really crack that. The good news is I think we're probably entering a period here in the next year or two where we will have a very good likelihood of getting federal legislation that will empower the states to enforce their sales tax law. We are working with our delegation in Washington and working with organizations like the Federation of Tax Administrators and the Multi-State Tax Commission. These are professional groups we interact with, working together to push that federal legislation. So there are some bills out there. We hope they pass. and that will go a long way toward solving the use tax problem. Finally, improving our tax compliance is clearly a challenge, a growing challenge for us. There's taxpayers are getting more and more creative in how they sort of navigate through the tax system, and we sometimes feel like we're always one step behind. But we do need more tools, better technology to sort of stay in the game. So we hope we can make some progress in that area. Those are our challenges in rough priority order. A little more detail on each of those. First, the aging and fragmented computer systems. I mentioned that we have a patchwork quilt of systems that we cobbled together with what funds we had available. Not an ideal situation. The department's current environment is that for any given process, we have different systems. We have 28 taxes. Many of those have their own systems. So if you're processing, for example, a payment, you may use one system if you're in the income tax division, and you may use another if you're in the sales tax division. It just doesn't make sense to have different systems for essentially the same kind of function. 143 applications resting on 11 different platforms. Some of the languages that we have for these programs date back to 1968. So we're in a situation where we think we're sort of getting in a tenuous situation where we could have a meltdown of our systems, a breakdown, if you will, that would be very disruptive. More on that. The cost of maintaining what we have today is getting more and more expensive. In some cases, vendors will not even support some of the languages we currently are using. So we're concerned about being able to do that. As we lose employees, in this attrition that I was referring to earlier, retirees, many of those people are going to go out the door and take with them their knowledge of these unique systems that we've had for years. And it's hard to sort of get coverage on that. I think one of the most tragic things about having a fragmented computer system is it really ties our hands in terms of being able to deliver services to taxpayers. When I want to check my bank account at my bank, I go online, and I can check all my different accounts. I can move money from one account to another, and I can go in and out of that with great confidence that I'm not going to have a problem with security. With what we have now, we simply can't do it. We just can't do what taxpayers expect to be able to do. Get online, check whether their refund has been paid, check whether their declaration payment has been registered on the system. We need to be able to do that, and we can't do it today. We have a difficulty giving taxpayers a good number when they call because we're not getting the number from a single source of information, which would be an integrated type of system. When employees move from one tax division to another, they need to be retrained because they often have to learn a whole bunch of new systems. I mentioned the risk of disruptions and failures from the old system, and I can't underscore that enough. One of the central systems in our scheme of computer systems is our taxpayer account system. That's where the important information about each taxpayer is stored. That's a very old system that needs to be replaced. And I mentioned the last point, the lack of inability to respond to the taxpayer. Got a little ahead of myself, I'm sorry there. I mentioned the different systems that we have. We came up with a pretty striking slide here that may help some of you wake up a little bit. It's pretty vivid. But across the top are the different tax types, income, sales, withholding, corporate, partnerships, and so on. Down the side are different processes, and we put four main processes on there: identifying taxpayers, filing and paying taxes, compliance functions, and collections. If we had an integrated tax system, we would have one color on this matrix. But every color here indicates a different system. So if you're processing a payment, depending on the income, the tax you're working with, you may have to deal with several different systems. So this is what we're struggling with in the Department of Revenue. In some sense, we're a victim of our own success. We've found ways on the cheap to put together a computer system that will allow us to get our work done and provide some level of service to taxpayers. But it's really time to step back and see if we can't do this in a better way. More on that later. Aging workforce, I mentioned in the next 5 years we're going to lose a significant number of our leadership. We're going to lose about 250 employees, one out of five through retirement. And replacing that collective experience and knowledge is going to be a real challenge for us and every other agency. One thing we did get from the legislature last year or the year before was an option for post-retirement called the post-retirement option, which is a real help to us and other agencies where we can retain, after some of these people retire, you can bring them back for a limited period of time and get some health benefits, and they can help us through the transition. So that's a very important piece of legislation. I will note, too, because of the loss of employees to retirement, these more experienced employees tend to be the ones who are the most productive. So if they're in auditing, you're losing your best auditors. And it's a real challenge for us to have folks ready to take over and fill in the gap. I mentioned the distribution of our employees by age. This was as of the January 1st, 2007. You see those under the age 30. In 2006, 202 employees. These are our newest employees. 31 to 40, 147. 41 to 50, 307. Over 51, 547. Now, if you put a line through the bars to try to get a line graph out of it, you start to have a U-shaped thing. And it's kind of frightening to me that because we're pulling in a lot of new young people through compliance initiatives, we're seeing a lot of retirements now happening. So we're sort of, there's a hollowing out effect in the distribution of the age distribution of the department. And we have our work cut out for us to figure out how we're going to get those first couple, four bars, if you will, up to speed and ready to take over for the people in the final set of bars of 50, 51 and over. And we are obsessing about that. We have all of our divisions doing workforce planning, and we question them about it. And I know every other state agency is doing that as well. I mentioned the competition for accountants. High demand has resulted from where accountants has resulted in high turnover rates for our newly hired employees. In a sense, we're operating sort of a training academy for auditors who get fairly cheap at no cost to them. In fact, they get paid to learn how to be good auditors, and then they get hired away by the private sector. This is not a good thing. We're investing a lot in these folks, and we need to keep them once they've been fully trained. One out of every three newly hired accountants leave the agency within 1 or 2 years. I mentioned the memo of understanding with the MAPE, and that has helped a bit, but we need more work. High turnover regularly diverts senior-level auditors and supervisors from high-yield audits to training. And I'll say as a sidebar, when we get compliance initiatives, we have to train new people that are hired with that initiative money. Yeah. And the trainers are typically the more experienced people, supervisors and more productive senior auditors. And so part of the reason why I think, as Deb mentioned, we're seeing some audits that are low yield, and we continue having these low yield audits is because we're doing a lot of training audits that are particularly, you know, not necessarily the highest use of our resources. The agency is pursuing these strategies to attract and retain employees. We're making our salaries, we're trying to make our salaries more competitive at the entry level, and that's the purpose of the MOU. We're working a lot with trying to identify ways to reward and recognize employee accomplishments, so trying to create a culture of appreciation and recognition. We're doing a lot of training, trying to expand learning opportunities for employees, something that would maybe cause them to think twice about leaving the department. And we're also looking at what we call life balance issues. For example, flex time. Employees like flex time. We're trying to accommodate that. Can we give them a little flexibility in terms of their hours? And we're continually looking at that.
You know, if I can interrupt.
Sure.
Hate to do this because you're doing so well, but one of the sessions that we're trying to set up, and I don't know if you've paid attention to the thing that's gotten a lot of publicity, of Best Buy's proposals of having employees able to work from anywhere in the world, and we're going to have them come in and talk to us about it. And it seemed to me that beyond flex time and telecommuting, this department ought to be a perfect set up for doing, when you look at everything, trying to do everything at once, you know, trying to get, if we're going to look at some new employee type of arrangements, and you're going to redo your computer systems, and we're going to look at what an entity like Best Buy has done, you know, your department might be a perfect place to pick out for an experiment on that.
I'm so happy to talk to you about that. And
okay, so just wanted to know that I'm thinking in that direction, and maybe you could too. Because I know that we've, you know, we wrote in requirements for building, I don't remember if it was before or after revenue was built, for buildings to be built, looking at telecommuting. I know that we've said lots of positive things about flex time and tried to do lots of positive things about it, but I just think a lot of it's been more lip service than actually doing it. And we'd like to see what a department would need to really move ahead and do that seriously. And what about the people that you bring back? Have you done it so that it doesn't affect their pensions at all, or it doesn't affect their pensions negatively? You know, how does that work?
Madam Chair, I believe the law is set up so it doesn't affect them negatively. So it's not an entitlement. It's up at the discretion of the agency head.
Sure.
And so we use it very selectively to keep people on a little longer in a mentoring mode or whatever we may need from them. So it's a great law, and it's going to help quite a bit.
Well, if there's anything we need to do to fix that or get work
appreciate
better,
that.
Madam Chair, my name is Dennis Erno. I'm Assistant Commissioner. I'm sorry for the...
That's okay. Come in.
Under the post-retirement provision, it's up to the discretion of the commissioner whether to employ a retired employee. They can work up to 1,040 hours, which is half of the year. And those hours can be constructed in any fashion. They can be all completed within a six-month period, or they can be are rationed out throughout the whole year. That provision will expire at the end of this biennium unless renewed by the legislature.
Okay. Has anyone said they're going to renew it, or is there a bill to do that?
I haven't heard.
Okay.
The other thing I just wanted to mention too is in connection with Best Buy, we have worked with Best Buy and brought Best Buy into our organization to work with us on rewards and recognition systems. And they work with our management team and on best practices on rewards and recognitions. They can do some things, of course, that we can't do, like token guest certificates and such. And the reason for that is our accounting systems won't let us.
You could give tax rebate certificates or something.
But there are some limits in state law that don't make any sense anymore. For example, one such limit is all agency heads are limited to $1,500 a year for employee events or recognition events, no matter what the size of the agency is. And for us, that doesn't even work out to 50 cents an employee. So,
Madam Chair, our retirement kicks are getting smaller and smaller.
Right. So there's some other things that could be done.
Well, you guys could work on sort of compiling a list of them. We're really interested in, I'm really interested, and I haven't seen anybody rising up in opposition from the committee in pursuing this. So.
Moving on. I mentioned the challenge of the growing diversity of the population. We need to expand services beyond our traditional outreach programs to growing numbers of folks who with limited English speaking abilities and skills. And it's a real challenge. We have taxpayers who have suspicion of government based on their experience with their own government, immigrant taxpayers, and we sometimes forget about that. We do have to, as quickly as we can, provide, as I said earlier, tax instructions in other languages as well as telephone assistance. And that's a real priority for us. I should mention, while it's on my mind, there was a comment earlier about 800 numbers. The department has taken steps to implement the reintroduction of 800 numbers to taxpayers effective on March 15th of this year. So I mention that because I know there's a lot of interest in that issue. The changes in the economy, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, Madam Chair. I know all of you are familiar with what's going on out there. Clearly, the economy is much more global than it's ever been. Borders are practically irrelevant nowadays in terms of international business. our tax systems sort of are built on the presumption that there are going to be clearly identified borders. Where does the transaction take place? We need to be able to see it and document it, and that's how we administer tax systems. Getting more and more difficult to do that with electronic transactions, virtual corporations that don't have to have a physical location. It can be a sort of a box of contracts somewhere, and relationships between affiliated entities. And it's becoming a real challenge to identify and enforce the business taxes. I mentioned electronic commerce, and I mentioned the federal legislation that we hope to see. I didn't mention earlier that, and this is a piece of good news, the states have been working since 2000 together to try to overcome the objection of the Supreme Court case in Quill. Their objection was an interstate commerce issue. They said given that every state had their own definitions of products and services, they had some nationally about 7,000 different sales tax rates. They made their own decisions about what was taxed and what was not. And therefore, they concluded a retailer located outside the state could not reasonably be expected to know all that, to know the administrative procedures and the rates and what was taxed and what wasn't. States got together and said if we made our sales taxes more uniform across the states, we could maybe overcome the Quill decision, either through taking another case up the Supreme Court or getting federal legislation. That process has matured, and at this point in time, we have about 15 states that have gotten completely uniform sales tax definitions, Minnesota included. There are another six states that are very close, and within a matter of another 6 months or so, will be fully conformed. And so there's a new governance structure that was built, and these states are hoping to administer this, what they call streamlined sales tax system, to be able to collect revenues that are owed to the state. It certainly will help to have federal legislation, and I think that's probably what we'll have to wait for. There are also, in terms of the economy, we have a shift from tangible goods to services. If you haven't noticed, Minnesota doesn't tax services. We have a few that we tax, sort of a selected list that were enacted in 1987, dog grooming and window washing and a few things. I used to joke that it's groups that were not well represented at the Capitol at that point in time.
Yeah, I've just found a group that is well represented.
So our sales tax, like every other state, was birthed in an industrial era where we taxed things. We didn't think about taxing services back in the early days. Well, as the population gets older, it tends to buy more services and less goods. So we're going to see a problem there long term. It's also true that the aging population has less taxable income. They simply are not going to be paying as much income tax as they would otherwise if they were younger. So these four things, I think, are all reasons why we need to be concerned about what's happening in the economy and how are we going to have our tax system track these changes. And it's not completely revenues issue. I mean, we'll administer the tax laws however they're enacted. But I think there's a growing awareness up here, and we certainly are flagging issues for the legislature, that over time the revenue system, the yield of the revenue system will fall because of these external influences. Growing complexity of our tax laws is another issue for taxpayers and for tax compliance. There's nothing like simplicity to increase voluntary compliance. Taxpayers understand what they need to do. And if it's not too complicated to sort of file their own tax return, we're going to get better compliance. But over time, the tax system tends to get more complicated. We tend to enact more exemptions, more credits. We tend not to repeal those because repeal is usually difficult politically. And so I've seen over the years great increases in complexity of our tax system. In 1986, the federal government simplified the federal tax system. It was a historic simplification. And they basically got rid of a lot of exemptions and deductions and reduced the rates to having, instead of six or seven or eight, they had three rates coming out, actually two coming out of the box. In 87, we looked at that new federal system and piggybacked our system on the new simplified federal system. And we reduced our income tax form to one side of one piece of paper. That wasn't the short form. That was the regular form that most people use. The short form was a half a page on one side. That was 1987, and today we have a form that looks more like pre-1986. So it's disturbing, and it is a challenge for us to administer that. The sales tax we've had, in 1995 we had 88 exemptions from the sales tax. In 2006 we have 153. This is sort of gravity. I mean, it's easy to pick up these things. It's hard to get rid of them. One thing we do provide, if you're not familiar with it, you need to take a look at it. We do provide a publication called the Tax Expenditure Budget, where we itemize all these special provisions that are exclusions from the general rule of taxation as defined in statute. And we put an estimate on how much revenue is being lost as a result of having a particular exemption or credit on the books. It was meant to be an analog to what you all do in the spending committee, as a tax expenditure, if you will, is really providing a benefit to taxpayers or citizens through the tax system rather than through a direct appropriation. So they're analogous. So you can see the growth and complexity there. Complexity is important. It increases the need for taxpayer assistance. Therefore, we need to go through more hoops and spend more money trying to get taxpayers to understand their obligations. It also means much more difficult and time-consuming audits. So there's nothing like simplicity to make our life simple as tax collectors. The footnote to that is, the more simple our tax system gets, potentially the less fair it is. And so you have these two warring principles. A simple tax system tends to not be very fair. Enough said. I mean, you can't have your cake and eat it too when it comes to simplicity and equity. Finally, the challenge, our last challenge, was improving the compliance of the tax laws. We know we have a lot of work there when you look at those tax gap numbers. By the way, we did the tax gap study as a management tool. It wasn't to flag, some number you could put in the budget. It was to say, let's measure the gap, even though it's very unrealistic and very theoretical. Let's measure it and then be able to look at it from year to year and see if it's going down. Are we making progress toward reducing the gap? But to have a significant increase in voluntary and enforced compliance, we need better data, better technology, simpler laws, better taxpayer service, improved enforcement tools, and a coordinated federal-state relationship. We do interact a lot with the federal government. Deb mentioned the Fed-State cooperation. We hope to be on board with that for tax year 09, filed tax year 10. So we're working hard on that. Next slide shows our base budget before the change items. This shows having $220 million appropriation for 08-09. And you can see the distribution between the general fund portion of that, about 94%. We have a healthcare access piece at 1.5, and highway special revenues and environment. But we're primarily a general fund tax agency, but we do handle a lot, as I said earlier, 28 different tax types, some of which feed the non-general fund portion of the budget. The governor has recommended four change items. The first is to modernize our computer systems. That one we flag as our highest priority. He's proposing an expanded tax auditing and enforcement initiative, another compliance initiative, if you will. He's proposing a compensation adjustment for a 2% adjustment. And finally, the creation of property tax information and data exchange systems. A little more detail on each one of those. I mentioned the integrated tax system, and I was focused primarily on why what we have now is so bad. I want to now talk a little bit about why having an integrated tax system would be so good. It would consolidate all these common functions for all the tax types into one single system. It would better integrate data for all tax systems, so we can have confidence in our data. The functions common to all 28 tax types are things like taxpayer business registration, knowing who the taxpayers are and get their identity on record, tax return and payment processing, accounting, auditing, delinquent tax collection, and the reporting functions that we need, reporting for the taxpayer as well as for management purposes. One of the issues the legislative auditor flagged in their report was the need for us to have better management data and to be able to select audits intelligently based on what the data is telling us. It's not easy to do that with the systems we have. And an integrated system will inform us as far as what is the productivity of auditors at different points and for different taxes. So we can sort of put the marginal dollar where we'll get the biggest bang. The advantages of the tax, an integrated system, it provides the same functionality for all types of taxes. It improves the quality of and availability of services to the public. More comprehensive data, as I mentioned, to inform our business decisions. Employees and taxpayers with accurate and timely information from a single system will be incredibly valuable. It will increase our effectiveness in tax compliance because we'll be more informed. It will lessen the risk of obsolete system failure, which is keeping us all awake at night. It mitigates the high cost of maintaining these legacy systems. And I should mention at this point that if you appropriate nothing for our systems, we will spend $7 to $9 million in the next biennium to update that checkerboard slide I showed you. So we will get no new functionality. We'll simply reduce the risk of failure a little bit, and we'll spend up to $9 million doing that. And I'll come back to that number when we talk about the cost of an integrated tax system. We would also ultimately get an increase in revenue and operational efficiency with an integrated tax system. Post implementation of a new system, I think you can count on a greater revenue yield from the tax system, from our efforts to get compliance. There's been a new wave of interest among the states in integrated tax system, and this is just an updated slide of states that have already adopted integrated tax system. They've jumped their piecemeal systems, and they've all had the kind of experience we've had, trying to keep things going with inadequate funding. So you see the list of states here. The amount they spent getting integrated tax systems varies tremendously from state to state based on how they arrange their contracts with the vendors. Some vendors have provided to build their systems in return for a share of the new revenue collected. Those tend to be the very expensive implementations. We're not talking about that in our proposal for an integrated tax system. We're talking about a straight-up appropriation and a much, much more modest total cost. The governor is asking in his budget for $39 million over 4 years for the integrated tax system. But that $39 million can be reduced by $11 million because the department will be able to redirect funding that would otherwise take place. We can redirect those funds for this project. So that would reduce the total to $28 million over 4 years. And that breaks down to $16 million in the 08-09 biennium and $12 million in the 10-11 biennium. So at a total
and
cost...
And this has gone through the Office of Technology's evaluation
this is
process?
This is blessed by the Office of Technology as one of their top priorities. It's in their top tier, flagged as a high priority and a potential enterprise application. So there may be other agencies that could use some of the functionality of this system. I should remind you that, again, we do collect non-tax debt, and we will be able to do that better with an integrated tax system. The other change item, the second one I mentioned, was the tax compliance initiative. The governor is recommending a $10.2 million appropriation for tax compliance efforts, additional tax compliance efforts. The breakdown of the $10 million is shown there by fiscal year. The initiative is expected to generate $51 million in 08-09 for a net gain of about $40 million. And yes, the department has had a successful history of tax compliance initiatives. I wasn't sure what Representative Spigen was referring to, but we certainly have not only met the promises we've made to the legislature, we've exceeded the promises we've made. That said, I think we are very concerned about where is that point of diminishing returns. As we've done more and more of these compliance initiatives, we are beginning to bump into obstacles. And right now, one of our chief obstacles is the lack of space in the Revenue Department building. So if we were to do much more than what we've already indicated we can do, we would probably have to go out and rent space outside the building, and that begins to pull down the rate of return. There's also tremendous training issues, and you have to find employees, you got to hire them, and you got to train them. That takes time. And so we're very reluctant to commit beyond the $51 million. This was a number we felt we could promise and be fairly confident that it would show up in the budget. But I didn't want to leave the impression that we've had a history of failure with compliance initiatives. That's certainly been not been the case. And as I said earlier, they've been certified by the legislative auditor. The department is working on the next change item is the compensation adjustment, and that's important to us. I think it's important to all the agencies. We are working hard to attract new employees in an increasingly competitive market. We also have the issue of trying to retain our newly hired employees, so anything we can do on the salary side, even if it's an across-the-board adjustment that affects all state employees, is going to be helpful to our issue with the auditors.
Are those ESME or MAPE employees? Or
it's both. I was going to say it's mostly MAPE, but I guess I don't know what the split is on that. So that the passage of that piece is going to be very helpful for us. Finally, the last change item is relatively small in terms of dollars, about $900,000 a year, to help us follow through on a commitment that was made by the legislature. In, I think, 2005, some money was provided for the state and for the counties to upgrade their technology so that we can exchange information more easily and to provide more web-based services. And we're making a lot of progress on that. And this slide indicates some of the pieces of that.
Is there a partnership of doing that with the county?
Absolutely.
Including paying for it?
The counties have put some money into this thing. Some of it was provided from the real estate transaction fees, which were increased in 2005. They're very enthusiastic about this. We're now at the point where we're getting counties signing up as early adopters of this prototype system. And one key element of it is to be able to get electronic certificates of real estate value. These are the paperwork that now comes in when there's a sale of property that we use to verify the value of the property. And we'll be able to get all that electronically. And there's just a long list of positive benefits from this kind of relatively modest appropriation.
Madam Chair, this might not be a question, I guess, necessarily best directed to you, but I'm wondering, as part of this initiative, you're working with the Secretary of State's e-recording task force, because these are all directly connected,
exactly,
recorded documents.
Of the so-called ERER, electronic real estate. I forget what the rest of the acronym stands for. I believe it's an outgrowth of that whole thing. I sort of got the ball rolling, and we started talking to the counties and found out they were very enthusiastic about working with us. We've exchanged a tremendous amount of information with them, state aid information, certifications of all kinds. So, and to do that on paper is just silly nowadays. This would be really a good thing to do. Great. Having mentioned those three, the four change items, but now look at our budget with the change items in. If, remember, it was 220 for the total of 0809. It's now, with the change items, $254 million. I should mention, when I was talking about the governor's proposed compliance initiative of $10.2 million associated with that is an increase of 68 FTEs. So I believe, Madam Chair, we are done. I hope not over time.
Thank you so much for doing that so efficiently. Are there any, Representative Costa?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question about local option sales tax. Last year, my city was able to actually get that through the legislature, and they passed it, and so they're beginning that process. And I'm just obviously wondering how much work that is additionally for you and the Department of Revenue, and what kind of assistance you give a city, a local government, when something like that happens for them.
On the margin, pick one city is not a big thing. We do administer the local sales tax option. As you know, when you adopt a sales tax option, it has to be, you accept the state's definition of things. So we're basically, you're piggybacking on our existing sales tax administration. So we track what's coming in and we provide the funds back to the communities. So it's the best way to do it, right? And we're lucky to be able to set it up that way. Many states are still struggling with how to do that, but we've had some early experience with that and working well.
Okay. Representative, before we adjourn, Representative Poppy moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? Motion passes. Any other last, we'll be continuing conversations, obviously. And I assume you'll probably be at the joint tax and...
Madam Chair, I'll make every effort to be there. Sounds like
Monday.
It'll be very helpful.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much. Meeting adjourned.